All right. Well, let's get started in our program. So glad that you're here today. And Susan Moore, so glad that you are here.
Thank you.
Let's kind of jump right in with our deep dive interview with Susan. Susan, tell us a little bit about where and how you grew up, maybe a bit about your parents and siblings. Just walk us through the beginning of Susan Moore.
Will do. We are from the Deep South, as we call it. My mother grew up in North Carolina, mostly in the Raleigh area. My dad grew up in North Carolina and Tennessee. He is a North Carolina State graduate in pulp and paper, and my mother went to nursing school in Raleigh. So, as we'll talk about in a little while, our daughter Rebecca is also a nurse, and my grandmother was a nurse, my mother is a nurse, and then it skipped a generation. So I'm really glad that we have that back in the family. So my parents met in Raleigh, and my dad then decided that he was going to do the paper mill route. So I grew up in Florida, Georgia, and Alabama. We lived in very small paper mill towns that always had the very interesting smell of paper mills. They're not as bad anymore, but every time we drove by, my mother said, "Don't worry, it's just the smell of money." So... grew up mostly in very, very small towns. My mother worked as a nurse for a while, and then when I was a preschooler and subsequent children came along, I have two younger sisters, then she retired from nursing mostly because we were moving around, but also because she wanted to stay at home, I think. I'm the oldest of three girls, no brothers. My middle sister is married, lives in Norfolk, Virginia. She met her husband through Bill and me. When we were in North Dakota in the Air Force, we introduced her to a friend of ours. They ended up getting married. They have five children live on the coast over in the Norfolk area. My younger sister is Jenny. She lives in Rome, Georgia, where my mother currently lives and is also married and is the greatest aunt in the world with no children. So that's our sort of structure of family.
Well, talk to me a little bit about your earliest memories and whether it was the smell of the paper mill or what. But what was your family like? I get the impression, or I have this picture now, that they're pretty close-knit. But what were some of the big things that you remember growing up, whether it was with your family or just kind of your adventures as a kid?
So I remember from a very young age going to see grandparents. Every week in the summer, we traveled to Tennessee and stayed with my dad's parents for a week. And that was the greatest thing ever. I had first cousins that lived nearby, and we could just roam free. And I have great memories of doing that. Now I understand how wonderful my parents also probably enjoyed that week. But at the time, it was just all about us and the fun that we were having. We had a great relationship with those grandparents. That grandmother is I think I've referenced this before, but she is the one who walked me out to an old storeroom in the back of their house to get something from an old refrigerator. And it was dark, and it was, I thought, creepy. And I said, "Mama, I'm scared out here." And she said, "Honey, you don't have to be scared. Jesus is always with you." I don't remember how old I was, but very young. And so from an early age, she was that sort of influence. Another memory that I have is my mother has always loved to travel. She has the travel bug and always has. And she had the goal of taking us to all 50 states. It took until after I was married, but she eventually accomplished her goal. So most summers we were traveling around, sometimes checking off multiple states at a time, but we were able to do that. So there were fun memories from family travels as well. I was a bossy big sister, and some of you can nod your head, and you may think I'm still bossy.
No.
I was an avid reader. Jonathan gets that from me, I think. And really from a young age, I loved handbells. We can talk about that more later. But I started ringing handbells in the second grade. And so I've been doing that for a long time.
Well, were you a good student in school? I'm thinking you probably were. Did you get in trouble ever? What was school like?
I was a good student. I was a people pleaser for the most part. So I have a vivid memory of being in a classroom and a teacher asking a question. And I raised my hand to answer the question. And she said, "Susan, let somebody else answer the question." And so she goes around, and I can't remember if somebody actually answered the question, but what I remember is that I had the wrong answer in my head, and that traumatized me for a while. So I think I was kind of quiet and shy, mostly in school. So no, I didn't get in trouble very much.
I didn't think so. What subjects were you drawn to? I know you later became a math teacher. Were you drawn towards math and numbers and things like that from the beginning?
Yeah, always. I was like my dad in that, who was not a degreed engineer. His degree was in pulp and paper, but he thought very much like an engineer. So,
what kind of classes do you take in pulp and paper?
You actually learn how to, you actually take classes in how to take trees and mm-hmm. make them into paper, along with a lot of management classes. Sure. So it's fascinating how to make paper from trees.
I think I went to a paper mill one time in a case, and it was really fascinating.
Yeah.
What do you think your love of handbells has something to do with also your being drawn to mathematics?
Yeah, absolutely.
Talk to us about that.
So Rachel, our middle one, did a project in Girl Scouts. And so about the time the research was coming out about the relationship between math and music, everybody is sort of shaking their head. But before that, I had a love, I think, of math and music. I've also told y'all before, I just had this really big drive to cure everybody of math phobia. I was a little naive in that. My friend Amy Grizzle Kane would tell me, "Don't even try with me. Like, you're not getting rid of it." But I think handbells for me was the music outlet. I played piano a little bit, but wasn't a great pianist or singer. So handbells was the.
What do you like about it? I mean, just the sound or the what it requires of you to follow along, or what's the magnetism there?
So one, you get to play as a team. So I was not athletic at all. So that was sort of my team sport. So I liked the team aspect of it, the ensemble aspect of it. And because you have a certain number of bells that you are in charge of, so that is something that you can control. So I did not have the talent of a Carla Brown to play the piano and use that many fingers, but I think I could ring the bells and also help the whole group sound as one.
Well, was there a particular person, whether it's a family member or a teacher, you mentioned your grandmother, I think, that sort of you really remember had an impact on you growing up and maybe helping to begin to form your how you saw life?
Yeah. I had a really cool high school math teacher. Her name was Mary Holcomb. She still lives in Rome. And she was a great teacher, but beyond that, she just had this magnetism, and she just wanted everybody to do well in her classes. So in addition to being able to communicate the material and make sure that you understood, you know, the question of why am I ever going to have to use this, she always had the greatest answer for that. And so I was drawn to that, and I think my love of things math and numbers and being organized, and then wanting to be like Mary Holcomb, I think, made me want to be a math teacher.
Well, and then you headed off to college. Where did you go to college? What did you study? What are some of the milestones there?
I went to Auburn University. My mother really wanted me to apply to a bunch of different schools, and I was having none of it. And, I mean, today's world, you just would never do that. But I wanted to go to Auburn, and I only wanted to go to Auburn. And so I did. It was a great – I loved college. I loved college football. I loved the friends that I made in college. And looking back on it, it was a really good place for me to start testing independence. Being a people pleaser at home, I got in trouble, but not anything. I wasn't a rebel. Going to college and living by yourself and being in charge of everything was really good for me. That continued into young married life as you kind of figure out who you are as an adult. But that's what happened for me at Auburn.
Yeah. And Auburn's still a big part of your life. I know you're a big football fan. Explain to me, are they the War Eagles or the Tigers?
They are the Auburn Tigers.
Okay.
That's their official mascot. The War Eagle is like a cheer, a cheer, a battle cry, and there's a long story about that. But the mascot is the Tiger.
And you met Bill there at Auburn, is that right?
Yes.
Tell us how y'all met and kind of how the relationship began to evolve.
I met Bill at Auburn First Baptist Church. I went to that church with a couple of my roommates freshman year, and I really wanted to have a college spring break trip. So I skipped out on the college choir tour for spring break my freshman year and instead went to Florida with some of my friends. But the next year, I went on the choir tour and met Bill Moore. My junior year, we started dating. Now, Auburn First Baptist Church is a really great place, but Bill Moore grew up there. His parents are professors at the university, and so he's been there his whole life. So I absolutely had to pass the test, and I'm not, it took a while for all the senior adults at Auburn First Baptist Church to decide that I was good enough to date Bill Moore. So we started dating. Actually, that's kind of a funny story. He asked me out for lunch right near the end of we were on quarters then. I had a final. We were going to go to lunch. And then my dad, who had his private pilot's license, was going to fly from Orange, Texas to Auburn to pick us up. My sister was also at Auburn at the time. The weather got really bad or was going to get bad, and he said, I need to come early and pick you up, and right, so we're going to leave like late in the morning. And I said, oh, no, I have a date. And so he was having none of that. So I had to cancel our first date, and it was at the end of the next quarter before I got another chance.
But, well, how did y'all's personality mesh together? What attracted you to Bill, and can you speak to what was attractive about you to him? Just talk a little bit about how that began to happen.
Well, we have a lot in common. We both loved all Auburn sports, so we did that a lot. He is a civil engineer by training, and so I think maybe our brains work a little bit the same. His parents especially were big Auburn basketball fans, so we spent a lot of time at Auburn basketball games.
Is that when Charles Barkley was there, or was that after or before?
He was there. His last year was our
so they're pretty
first
good.
Year.
And they, yeah.
Yeah, they were pretty good then. Yeah. In fact, on one of those college choir tours I talked about, Auburn made it to the Elite Eight round of the NCAA tournament, and we were traveling. So our music minister took us to a mall, and we found a Radio Shack, and all these televisions were up against the wall, and they let us watch the basketball game in the Radio Shack. That was surprising. Bill's parents also were a wonderful part of the package for me. Before we even had language for this, we both grew up moderate Baptists. And Bill's mom was a strong leader in her own right. It was a long time, much, much later in her life, that she was ordained a deacon at that church, but she was one her whole life. She was chairman of the school board in Auburn, and she taught me a lot about how leadership works, how graceful leadership works. She was a very polite, southern woman, very hospitable, and just really wonderful.
Yeah. And so did you get married after graduation?
Yes.
Okay. And then what happened?
So we, Bill graduated, and the Air Force had up to a year to send you active duty. And in Bill's case, it was 11 months after he graduated that he got his orders and went active duty. And it was in those 11 months, I was a junior, that we started dating. So if the Air Force had had different ideas, there wouldn't have been a Bill and Susan. So he left to go to the Air Force. I finished up at Auburn, and then we got married after that. He did meet me at a class one day. I came out of class, and he was standing across the hall, and I thought somebody had died. That was very unusual. And so I walked out, and he said, "Well, I got my orders." And I said, "Great," because he's a civil engineer. The civil engineering squadron is in Florida. And I said, "So we're going to Florida." And he said, "No, actually, we're going to Minot, North Dakota." And I said, "That's bait and switch. That's not fair."
So that wasn't a deal breaker for you, though.
Well, it was too late at that point. Yeah, it might have been earlier on. I don't know.
Well, tell us about that experience or that adventure way up north.
Well, thankfully, my mom kind of instilled the love of adventure because it was one. So we drove to North Dakota, and you know, I didn't have clothes to live in North Dakota. I have only lived in the very deep South. So, and we drove after our honeymoon. We drove to North Dakota. We stopped in Grand Rapids or Fargo, I think Fargo, for dinner, went in for dinner and came out and the car door had frozen. And there's, you know, so those kinds of things, I don't know how to live in this world. I've never done this before. But it was a great first place to be married. The nature, at least at that Air Force base of, you know, it's very transient. People are coming and going all the time, but you just make good friends really quickly. And we did. And it was just the pace of life there is much slower. Not on base. Bill had a very stressful job. He was a missile launch officer. But the pace of life in town and around the area there was much slower. While we were in North Dakota, there was one murder in the entire state. It was that kind of place. There were only 500,000 people in the entire state, so it was very different from where we grew up. We made the best friends there, lifelong friends. Some of you have heard me talk about my Ella J trip. Ella J is a small town in North Georgia, and there was a mountain house there, and the group of girlfriends from North Dakota started traveling to Ella J every year for a long weekend. And if everybody comes, there's about 9 of us, but we also were friends in North Dakota. So almost all Air Force wives, that friendship continues to this day. So that's what Minot did for us.
And you started teaching there, is that right?
I did.
Tell us about that. I remember in your sermon you talked about teaching some of the Air Force folks. Talk to us a little bit about what that was like.
I did. I couldn't wait to cure the world, right, of math phobia. So I can't wait to get into a high school and teach high school math. In North Dakota, they have good education programs. And in the college, and teachers get into the schools and they stay for their whole careers. There was no, at least at that time, there was no moving around, which meant there were no openings for math teachers. I did have one offer at a school about 45 minutes away from the base, and they offered me $6,000 to teach at the full time to teach at this school, and we decided there would be other opportunities because I've not driven in this ice and snow before, so that might not be a good idea to start out. So Bill was standing at the copier one day in one of the buildings. He was getting his master's degree at the time, and he heard one of the managers of one of the schools there talk about needing a math teacher. So he asked some questions. And come to find out, they did need a math teacher and interviewed me. And so I got to be an adjunct professor on base for Embry-Riddle University, which is actually in Florida. But they had classes there for the enlisted folks on the base, so mostly flyers. So I got to teach there. And then I had an opportunity to teach at Minot State University, which was in town. It was also a great first teaching job because I had no responsibilities other than teaching. I didn't have to research. I didn't have to do much advising. I could just teach. So I got some good experience there.
Well, so set the stage now for us for family coming with the kids. Where was, I guess Jonathan was first. Where was Jonathan born there? Was that later?
Or? He was.
Okay, talk to us a little bit about Jonathan first, and we'll get to Rachel and Rebecca over there.
Jonathan cost $26 to have. He was, we were in the Air Force at the time, and brand new hospital had been built on the base, so that was great. I had had done some Red Cross volunteering, so I had some relationship with the OBs and the nurse midwives on base there. Bill was not on alert. So he was not down in a missile silo, but he had just gone through a lengthy process of going through all the top secret clearance stuff to get to what he was doing for the day when I called and said, I'm in labor. We need to go to the hospital. He said, okay. So he had to do the same anyway. It took him a little while to get home. So Jonathan was born on the Air Force base. Some of these really good friends that I talked about were already parents. So we also had the opportunity to learn from them about how to be parents and what kind of parents we wanted to be. So Jonathan was 6 months old then when we left North Dakota. So both Rachel and Rebecca were born here in Houston.
Talk to us a little bit about, your kids are great, about the differences sort of in their personalities, maybe how you dealt with them differently as they grew up, a little bit about maybe what connects you with each one of them and how they're different from one another.
So two of the three are here, for those of you in the front. So they probably should come up and speak for themselves. Jonathan has always been an avid reader. We were just this week talking about this story. One time Jonathan was in middle school, and I was walking down the hall volunteering for something else. But I just happened to pass his class, and it was, I think it was a history, you think? And so he has his textbook up, just like a good student. And then inside the textbook, he has another novel of some sort that he's reading. And, you know, he would have totally gotten away with it, except that I was walking down the hall. And I thought, one of the things you never expect is that your children will get in trouble for reading. You know, never. But he was that child that we would have to finally turn out the light. You have to go to sleep. You have to stop reading now. And still is that way. I think Jonathan gets that from my mother and from me. More books than we'll ever read in a lifetime, right? Jonathan has always loved music and graduated from HSPVA right down the street. And I think there probably found a love of theater. So he went off to college to Trinity University in San Antonio and graduated with degrees in both music and theater. And since then, can I just keep talking about their whole lives? Since then, has been was attracted to the more the business side of theater, and has been stage managing for all over the country, really. Most often in San Diego for the San Diego Opera. But just a few months ago, moved back to Houston and is stage managing now for the Houston Ballet. So we are very excited to have him back in town. Jonathan, as a child, liked things in order. He did not like change. And so that's sort of, you know, a fairly typical oldest child, right? Rachel was born here while we were living in a small apartment. We first came to Houston for a six-month training program, and 26 years later, here we still are. And so we were living in a small apartment when Rachel was born. Jonathan was two and was actually very sweet to Rachel. So he was one of the first people to sing to her, which was really sweet. Rachel has always loved children and loved animals. Some of you have seen her play the harp, and she is the introvert of the three children, and she is married to Zach, who is also an introvert. So Zach is an only child of only children, so when we all get together, maybe is still kind of learning how to navigate that situation. Rachel was also the athlete of the three and really enjoyed playing softball and field hockey and is a runner now. They live in Athens, Georgia. And Rachel is, she graduated from Furman and the University of Georgia, and she is a child life specialist. I think we'll come back around to church maybe in a minute, but the connections that children have at church, I learned, were just crucial. Kate Lane was a youth teacher in the youth group when my kids were there, and she came to Rachel one day and said, "I have a friend who is a child life specialist, and I think you'd be a great child life specialist. You should talk to her about it." So she set up a conversation with them, and Rachel shadowed this person, and that's what she's doing today, is a child life. I had never even heard of a child life specialist. I didn't know what it was. So Rachel's over in the Southeast, and they are learning how to be married adults, but we keep in touch. Rebecca is kind of has the sharpest wit in the family, and she keeps us laughing. Rebecca is in tune. See, two R names. That's been, bless her heart, her whole life. Rebecca has always cares about people and has Bill's gift of sarcasm. So occasionally I can see it because I'm her mother, and the way she shows love to people is with words. And occasionally
with biting sarcasm.
And occasionally in our house I will have to say to the two of them, please turn down the sarcasm. Like it's too much right now. Rebecca is, even till today, but even when she was young too, is an extremely loyal friend. She is the one who will almost every day be in contact with a friend that she has made along the way, and has, both from high school and college, has great relationships that she nurtures even now. She graduated from Samford University and is a nurse, and also has moved back to Houston and is in the nurse residency program at Methodist Sugar Land right now. One of my favorite things about my kids is that they have what they call sibling weekend. They try to do this every year. And how many of you had three or four maybe? At four, and so every year they try to go to a different place, and parents are not invited. It's just the three of them. They're trying to decide whether Zach's going to be invited, can in-laws come or not, but it's time that they get to spend together, and I was not prepared for just the, you know, how thrilling that would be to me that my kids would want to spend time together even when they lived all the way across the country. So
yeah, that's remarkable. That's good sibling and good mothering and parenting,
I think
too. So what talk to us a little bit about what got you here to Houston, what got you here to South Main maybe in particular, how did that happen, and then I want to get into sort of the different roles you played at South Main. We've got
So when we got out of the Air Force, did a little teaching while Bill was looking for a job, and he got a job in Houston, again, that six-month training program. So we came here, and we knew one person in Houston, and that was Ken Williams, who was in our wedding, a really good friend of Bill's. They grew up together in Alabama. And Ken said, "You got to go to South Main." So we said, okay, so that's how we came here for the first time. And then once Jonathan and I joined Bill in Houston, then we joined South Main, and we were in the chapel. Bill and I were singing in the choir, and we actually joined on a Sunday night from the choir. So Bill Turner had to kind of turn around and find us. But
and what year was this?
That was 26 years ago. That was 93.
93. That's when Kelly and I came, too. Talk to us a little bit about how that morphed into sort of a Christian vocation of being involved in the church, and how that led into the different roles that you began to take on.
So one of the pieces of wisdom that Bill's mom gave me early on was, find your place of service and serve there. And my go-to was going to be to teach children. But I turned that down a couple of times. And she said, never turn up your nose at being the people in an adult class who can nurture and grow an adult class. So we did that for a little while. And then Nancy Campbell called one day and asked if I would be the child care coordinator. It was about a 12-hour-a-week job. I started, Sharna Sherrill has done that job, and took care of the Smile Nursery and the Sunday child care workers did their schedules and Wednesday nights, and it was the perfect part-time job for me. Yeah. So that's how it started.
And then what was next? And how did it get you from there to now kind of the core of the staff, Minister of Communications? What's your title now?
Minister of Administration for Communications.
Okay. Get us from where that was to now where you are.
Loved being on the preschool hall and taking care of getting to know young families in the church and getting to work with our child care workers. After Steve came, I had done a couple of rounds of the interim children's minister job. So we had a conversation about what that might look like going forward, and that I was not called to do that. So after he had been here just a little while, he asked if I would be in charge of the calendar. My family will laugh because we have had since I was a little girl, we have had calendar sessions at my house, wherever my house happened to be, and we still do. And some people will sit through it with me, and sometimes I do it by myself, but that's okay.
It still happens.
It does. It still happens. So when Steve asked me to be in charge of the calendars, I just thought how there couldn't have been a dream job that I would have loved more than to do that. And Steve came from a much smaller place where he could do all of that, and South Main was not that place. So he allowed me to do that. That morphed into the job that the title was ministry coordinator. So I was in charge of the calendars, and I was on the pastoral team, but I was not an ordained minister. So then the next step was continuing to sense the call to ministry and finally saying, yes, I will do that, and asking the church for ordination and going through that process. And then now I have this long title.
Yeah. Well, about the ordination process in particular, do you feel any different now that you've been ordained? Do you feel a different sense of weight or responsibility, or was that like, talk to us a little bit about season before that and season after that, what that process was like.
So Peter Allman would take my ordination away if I didn't say yes. I felt different.
Peter kind of delivers that gravity to you.
Yeah.
He just hands it off to you.
Well, no, what I really appreciated about Peter walking through that process is because I think the call is mostly between me or any person and God, right? And you can say yes or no. But Peter helped me understand that once you are ordained, and the Holy Spirit may have other ideas about where you are, and you may have different jobs, you may go to different places, and you have to be open to that. And of course, he was right about that, but it helped me process that. The ordination council was a weighty thing, but a reassurance, I think, that we were walking in the right direction.
Yeah. And what are your core duties now? I think I know this, but tell everybody kind of what your, I may not know your title, but I know what your duties are. Talk to us a little bit about what you do now, like what a normal day is like.
Right.
When you're not doing an interview.
Right. So I have the greatest team around. Dolores will argue with me about that, but I have the greatest one. So Jennifer Gribble and Suzanne Herman and Eric Peterson and I make up the communications team. And Jennifer and I especially have dreamed for years about what this team might look like. And I think we are still growing as a team, but I get to kind of steer our work together, and things like the Fount and other communication pieces come out of really good collaboration with that team. I'm still in charge of the calendar. I'm not sure I'm going to give that up.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about that, because when we have calendary meetings, we have calendary meetings, and they're sometimes they're long calendary meetings, and I'm sometimes complain a little bit. Uh-huh. I acknowledge that. But everything flows from that. Talk to us a little bit about that process of it looks like a calendar up on the wall, but suddenly you get publicity from it, and you get events from it, and you get work orders from it, and how it all kind of comes together. But it sort of starts when you begin to put something up on the calendar.
Yeah. Charis and I have talked about this before. It's just a really wonderful life when the way that you are wired and ministry can work together. So I tell the staff all the time, if we're not careful, the calendar will drive us. And even though my wall in my office is completely covered with calendars so that it looks like wallpaper, it's really important that we drive the calendar. So that's sort of the trick some days, is to stay ahead of that and to think big picture about what it is at this place and this time that God wants us to do, and how do we make the calendar work for us in that way. And so, yes, last Thursday we went to the youth center, and Greg had to sit through all day of calendaring, which is not his favorite thing. But I love the way we work together. It keeps the ministries from being siloed when we talk about things like that. Steve and all of us really can talk about what are our priorities right now, and how can we make the calendar work for us.
Well, and your job also involves a lot of kind of navigating through that, problem solving with different groups, like because you're the in addition to your new title, but you still are kind of the coordinator of most things. Most things kind of go through Susan, and so she's working a lot with Carrie and Carrie's program and Dolores's program. When funerals come up, we have a lot of interaction, that sort of thing. So tell us a little bit about your job as a problem solver, as almost a juggler and coordinator of all this things, and maybe give us an example of that.
Well, I think when things work well, then people don't even know that that happens, and that's the way I would want it to be most days. But we had a situation come up just in looking out a couple of weeks, and we called it ahead of time because we had a good communication where we might have had a resource conflict, so a space that somebody wanted, that two people wanted at the same time. So there's some of that conflict resolution that doesn't really rise to a high level of that. Sometimes, though, much bigger experiences and opportunities come along, and one of those that you may know about now is the change of days for some of our ministries. So our church is growing, and especially our family ministry is growing. We have Parents Day Out program called Play Days on Tuesdays and Thursdays that is really growing, and our Smile program is really growing, and those two things happen at the same time on Tuesday mornings. So over the last year, now year and a half, we realized we are now limited to who can come to these programs because of our nursery space. And as you can imagine, on our staff, we worked really hard at what are the best options for solving this wonderful, what a great problem to have. And still, logistically, there are things that have to be changed, and not all of us like change. So starting in January, Smile is moving from Tuesday to Monday, and Mainstreamers and your programs will move from Mondays to Tuesdays. And I think, there were some conversations that needed to had and process that needed to be followed. But for the most part, everybody understands that really this is for the good of the whole and for the growth of the church. And now both of those programs now are free to grow as big as they want to.
Yeah. So, well, talk to us a little bit about kind of what you're most excited about now. I know there's been some new things in the communication efforts to the church, and I really have noticed. Maybe this is the difference between being on the inside on staff, but I mean, I do remember several years ago, a lot of years ago, people saying, "Well, I didn't know that was happening. I didn't missed that because you know, no one told me that, or I didn't see that anywhere. And I think that's gone down a lot. But talk to us a little bit about how the church has communicated with about events, about things, and maybe about what you're most excited about more recently.
Great. So when there were several years when my three children were in three different schools, and I got lots of information from all three different schools, and there was no way I could read all of that and keep up with that. So when somebody says, it doesn't happen very often anymore, but when somebody says, I didn't know about that, and I feel like it has been all over the place for 2 months, I try to remember that and not say, how come you didn't read what I gave you? Because that's just the world we live in. We are just bombarded with messages of all kinds, right? But I do think that's going well. I think on my sabbatical last year, I worked with a consultant about when should we send emails, how many emails should we send, what should the opportunities piece look like, and those kinds of things. And we talked about the magazine as well. So all of that communication works together, and my communications team helps me with ideas and, as Suzanne likes to say, keeping me into the current century and not decades ago. But I'm excited about the communications team just becoming more and more and more high functioning as a team. And I think the church will benefit from that, I hope. I'm also excited about just anticipating the change around us and how we can best communicate to people that way. So my job really is about making connections between church members, between staff and church members, and between South Main Baptist Church and the world. So as we learn new ways to communicate with the world, I think that will change as we go forward, and I'm excited about that.
Yeah, do you have a sense of whether that's going to kind of tilt a little bit? I mean, or can you do both robustly at the same time? Or because I do have a feeling if there's more people in our community and that we're kind of a part of this district, that we really do have to communicate outwardly very, you know, vibrantly. Yeah. What do you anticipate as far as that in terms
of
change?
I think we will have to do both. How much of each we do, I think, might shift some in the days to come, and it sort of depends on back to the priorities of this congregation and how we decide we want to interact with the world. And I think as long as the communication stays clear and engaging and inspiring, then hopefully we can accomplish both. Communication to our congregation that then enables our congregation to communicate with the outside world. And some of that, honestly, is a function of how many hours are there in the day, in the week, that we can get that done. But
yeah, and capacity for, like you say, messages. You can only receive so many messages. Right. Well, what about in your family or personal life? What are you looking forward to? What's kind of on the horizon for you? You're an empty nester now.
We didn't mention
that two of the kids live together now.
Yes,
right?
I forgot to say that. I think so. Since Jonathan and Rebecca have come back to Houston, they have now moved out of the house and have an apartment together. And I think it's going really well. Is it going really well so far? Good, good. That has just happened in the last month, 6 weeks. So that's brand new. So the house is pretty quiet, except having adult kids is just really great. They are so fun. Rebecca's a huge Astros fan, so she's going to, when her schedule allows, she's going to come over to the house and watch the Astros game with me. Jonathan and I went to the Alley a couple of weeks ago and saw, what was that we saw? Winter's Tale, yes. So that was great. And so it's very fun having them in town and getting to see them. And it's quiet at the house. Bill is now working on a project in Corpus Christi. So during the week, he is about 3 hours down the coast and home on the weekend. So Right. Bring food when you come. That'd be
And you awesome. You actually do have visitors a lot. You've got, like, whenever there's a flood, you have visitors.
Yes.
You've got choir folks that are staying with you when a choir comes in. Talk just briefly about some of your mission work. You open your doors to folks when they're in need. You go down to Peru. How many times have you been to Peru?
16
times.
Maybe, like
just
that.
Talk to us about, and this will end on this, but what sort of, what draws you to be able to open your house, to go to Peru, to really kind of have a very open mind to what God wants you to do and where to go and how to do it?
I love being around people. So when I'm never frustrated with Greg ever, but if I ever were, I would just tell him that he's got to come live in my commune, because he would hate that. And, but
we have introvert issues and we have font issues occasionally as well.
We do have, yeah. Fun. So, you know, Greg is the greatest on the staff, and he is constantly pushing my boundaries, and he's going to suggest things that are really fantastic, and so he and I have a great back and forth on that. So I really could live in a commune with all of you, but, you know, at any time, and I just tell my family. So I love having people around, and I don't mind being by myself. I enjoy quiet sometimes too, but I can have people at my house all the time. So it was really a no-brainer when people close to us needed a place after Harvey, and they came and stayed. And we had kids in the house. It was really great. I think Peru for me started as a chance to go on a mission trip with my mother. I think they really needed her as a nurse more than they needed me, but we got to go together, and so I had a chance to work with the OSA kids in Peru at VBS, and she had a chance to go and nurse for a week, and she still does that once or twice a year, so many great things that'll have to be another program that I learned from that ministry and watching the OSA kids and learning that in some ways children are the same all over. It is true. They teach us as much as we teach them. But
well, Susan, thank you very much. For answering the question. It looks like we might have a question from the fans in just a second.
Uh-oh.
But, what you do also, there's, and so many people, and Tom Williams was like this too, but you see a little bit of what Susan does, but underneath the surface, there's this huge iceberg of things that she does too. And so thank you for doing that, for what we see and also for what we don't see. You're offering your giftedness to the church and to God and to ministry is just really remarkable. And so thank you for being here today.
You're welcome.